Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We are a podcast that translates legal jargon into understandable, everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and with me is my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Hi, Gail. You ready to go?
I am so ready to go, Judge. Are you ready?
I hope so. We'll give this a try. Today, folks, we're going to talk about the concept of neutrality of judges and really how the objectivity of judges is often like perhaps the objectivity aspired to by journalists. So we're also going to discuss the necessity in court of hearing both sides of an issue and compare that to journalists also hearing from both sides of political conversations. Part of this discussion, not all of it, but part of it was prompted by a recent controversial situation caused by the National Association of Black Journalists, and we may refer to that as NABJ throughout our conversation, inviting Donald Trump to speak to its annual convention in Chicago, and that caused all kinds of furor and turmoil. But let's start with judges. And Judge Gail, let me toss out a definition for you. As judge, I've always tried to define what the courtroom is as a neutral forum for the resolution of disputes. Now, that's just my definition, a neutral forum for the resolution of disputes. It's not always that way because it's not always neutral, but that's what we aspire to.
I was just going to say it's aspirational.
Each judge, though, as much as we try to be neutral, we all come to the bench with our own worldview, our own upbringing, our own baggage, our own biases. We're not free of those. We're human beings. But we try to set those aside. Talk about that concept from your perspective, how you did that. You know, we come from different backgrounds. I'm a blue-collar, first-generation college white guy, and you're a black woman judge. We come to this from different backgrounds, but we both have to try to set aside those backgrounds to address issues fairly.
Absolutely. And, you know, amazingly, you know, notwithstanding ethnicity, our backgrounds are strikingly similar. And therefore, it's that reminder that no matter who we are and where we come from and what walk of life we hail from, we want the same things from our systems of justice and from all of our accountability stakeholders in society, right? So we want them from our mayors, our legislators, our reporters, everybody.
If I'm a person in court, I don't want to be treated differently in your court as opposed to my court. I want both of those courts to be equal.
Absolutely. Yes. And mind you, just as you said, you know, the goals of the court being neutral is aspirational. It's something that we don't perfectly achieve. And the reason is because you got human beings running it. Let's just, you know, start with that as a basic premise. You have human beings that are in charge of the process, and we don't always get it right, but we can work hard to get it right. And some of the things that I think that judges should be really focused on doing are simply very, very basic, which is, it starts with, how do you even address someone? how do you even address parties? Do you refer to them by their first name? Are they Mr. or Mrs.? Are they Tom and Jenny? So, because you're expected to be judge. And if you're expected to be judge, then how are you treating them so that they are going to respond to you respectfully? And to me, that sounds basic, but in some courtrooms, that's not always a rule that's followed. What do you think about that?
I always opted for familiarity breeds contempt. And so I tried to be as formal as I could without being over the top. I would refer to someone as Mr. or Ms. And I would refer, if they had a title, it would be doctor or whatever, because I wanted to breed an atmosphere of respect in my court. So if I showed that I respected the people before me, there was a greater opportunity for them to respect me and my position. As I said, in judgment of whatever issue was before me.
And I absolutely agree with that. I think, as you said, it shows and it actually signals to everybody in the room, not just how you're treating the person in front of you, but how they can expect to be treated. And it also signals for them that if they're going to be treated this way, it, I think, increases the likelihood that you'll get compliance and you'll get reciprocating respect, as opposed to, as you said, familiarity breeds contempt. And trust me, it's enough folks that walk in courtrooms that are contemptuous already. They figure they've got the, they Let's already see, know the process.
Their hat's backwards. There's obscenity on their t-shirt. What else have we got?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. They are mean mugging already, you know, slouching in the seat and... You know, you can tell even from tone, right? So even if they are dressed to the nines, you can tell how someone's preparing or planning to respond to you based on just the tone and how they answer. If it can be, you know, hello, Mr. Smith, how are you this morning? And you can either get a yes, Your Honor, or a yeah.
And if you get the yeah, how far do you let that go? Again, this neutral forum for the resolution of disputes, I always believed there had to be decorum in a courtroom. Now, unless there was a jury trial, I didn't wear robes much of the time. I didn't go that far. I thought there had to be some sense of informality, but there had to be decorum in the courtroom. And I thought that decorum really added to the objectivity perception that's given by the judge.
Absolutely. You know what? You're absolutely right. And sometimes you can have decorum and contempt. The two aren't necessarily exclusive, right? So, for example, I'll use... You know, as we were kind of setting this up earlier, and although this is not a courtroom setting, but I think, again, there's some similarities. If we talk a little bit about how the NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, really set up an environment that was really, you know, laced very well with a lot of decorum, it clearly reeked of contempt, however, with the response to the very first question. I don't think that the environment lacked decorum. I think everyone that was there was a professional, including the former president, who, you know, he came professionally dressed. He came, I think, expecting to answer questions. I don't know if he expected tough questions. And I think that he understood that he was walking into an environment with a sizable representation of minority journalists. After all, it was the National Association of Black Journalists. And so certainly he could have, or his team should have, prepared him for that. And so there's clearly that idea of decorum, just as you would expect in a courtroom, right? You've got the judge who's seated and is prepared, and everyone is there respectful. And yet From the very first question from that experience, I think the bottom fell out with, you know, the addressing what was called the elephant in the room, which, by the way, judges often have to do a lot of in,
exactly.
in providing individuals an opportunity to be heard. You got to sometimes address the elephant in the room in order to get to the next step, in order to resolve things in that, you know, very neutral or objective environment. And I think that happened. And it doesn't seem like, it seemed like that's when the contempt actually met the decorum and the bottom fell out.
Well, and I think there are a lot of similarities between the situation at the NABJ convention and courts. And there are a lot of similarities between journalists and judges. People always ask me, how have you been able to handle both roles as an attorney and a judge and roles as a journalist, and thinking that they're really separate? They aren't. They're very, very similar. You're on a search for the truth. You're trying to be as objective as possible. You're trying to be as fair as possible. And you're trying to allow all sides to be heard. Both of those things are the same if you're in the courtroom or if you're covering a story.
In the newsroom, right? So whether it's the courtroom or the newsroom. And I want to, now I'll have to also say, you know, for our listeners, this is full disclosure. I certainly, in my experience as a judge, I know, believe, and practice that as a jurist. I sometimes had my, you know, times of skepticism when it came to journalists, that was the goal being achieved, because I felt like, you know, depending on who was being highlighted, that there may have been sometimes some agendas there. But I do genuinely believe that the aspirational goals of journalists are so in line and in tandem with what judges do every day in the courtroom that I actually would think journalists should understand the role of the court perhaps better than most, because it's so well aligned. What do you think?
Well, it is well aligned, and it's one of those things where two entities are too similar, and therefore they don't understand each other. oftentimes, journalists and judges are both trying to do the same thing, but yet they're speaking different languages to each other. So there's this inherent mistrust. But I want to go back to, if we could, to the search for the truth. Mm. And I think that's foundational to both what journalists are trying to do and what judges try to do. That's what you're doing. You're searching for the truth. Now, I think judges have an advantage in that process, and I'd like to get your viewpoint on that, because judges have rules that we have to follow. We have rules of procedure. We have rules which for people out there mean how things are supposed to go in court, what certain motions can be filed under what deadlines. All of these things are procedures that you have to follow. There are rules of evidence, which tell you what testimony or documents you're allowed to look at in a trial and be admitted, and what should not be admitted. So judges have rules in their search for the truth. Journalists, not so much.
I was just going to say, it seems to me that for judges, the search for the truth is more of a mandate and a requirement that also has a handbook and specific guidelines to accompany it. And those guidelines are so specific that, just like you said, it includes actual guidelines on the process itself. This is how you go about searching for the truth. This is who's included in that process. And here is the information or the evidence that is permitted to be used in that search for the truth. for journalists, I do not understand that their requirement, they, first of all, are not mandated, although I think the journalists that are certainly true to the craft are absolutely embracing this same credo as part of who they are, except they are not necessarily provided the same handbook or guidelines or even, you know, even mandates. But they still have these same aspirational goals that, just like judges, they desire to hear from all sides. There are very few times when I would have a case, or no time actually, when I would have a case and I'd say, you know what, this time, you know, only the defendant gets to speak. And, you know, since the defendant is self-represented and doesn't have an attorney, I'm going to let them speak more and say more and do more because, you know what, they just need a little extra. And if they don't get it right, I'm going to help them out. That's just never been the case as for me as a judge. And also to say to the prosecution, well, you know what, you're law trained, you're fine, you don't need to really chime in. It's, you know, we're going to just give this one to the defendant. That doesn't bolster fairness for anyone. And I think for journalists, they desire the same thing. They are often dealing with situations where there are multiple voices to be heard. They need to hear from multiple sides. They're trying to parse, you know, which part is true, which part maybe kind of teetering on a knife's edge of whether or not it's true. And that they have to be able to digest all of this in order to relay information to others, because they too want to be seen as trustworthy and reliable, just like judges do. They want to be counted on, and they want to be able to assure those who look to them for truthful, objective, trustworthy information. They want those folks to be able to return to that source time and time again for that same thing. And I think that provides or adds value to the work they do in the same or similar way that it does for judges.
Let's talk, if we could, about false equivalencies, because they apply to the courtroom as well as journalists. And that means, my definition of that is that someone says something and you listen to it, and then you go to the other side, or that you evaluate that first comment. You evaluate that first comment. Let me do this way. And it's so outrageous that, do you have to go to the other side, or can you just say, that's outrageous? You see what I'm saying?
Because fact-checking.
it's not just fact-checking. It's giving people an opportunity to say absurd things. And that, I think, was part of the debate with the NABJ situation. In fact, one of the convention co-sponsors resigned from her position because she was against having President Trump even come to this journalistic situation and spread what she thought and others thought would be lies and vitriol. You know, do you allow that? And there is so much debate within NABJ and journalism sources otherwise as to whether that was just giving a forum for lies and vitriol. Now, do we do that same thing in court? Do we give people forums for just lies and vitriol?
I think judges are able to better control the environment when it is the spewing of lies and vitriol. The other thing is, in that the spirit of objectivity, judges have the opportunity to ultimately take all of that information and distill it into an opinion, or they can pronounce something at the conclusion. And they often masterfully go point by point and dissect whatever those statements are, rebutting them or making specific findings that diminish the value of those statements. For example, if I had an extremely, you know, highly emotional and angry defendant who just insisted that their, you know, closing argument in a bench trial, or meaning a trial to just me, not to a jury, that their closing argument was just going to be full of a tirade against the victim in a case and not really focused on the facts, or maybe just maybe barely focused on the facts, I might permit them some time to address those things out of fairness so that they can have had a voice and have had an opportunity to be heard, even when I understand that that information or what they're saying may not be correct. It is not pertinent, and it does not go to any of the important elements of the case. What I can do as a judge is at the conclusion of the case, I can refer back to those statements and I can go point by point and say, you know, Mr. and Ms. So-and-so, you said these things, here's what the court finds. I find that those things, that nothing's been, there's no evidence provided to support it. I don't find that it's true. I find that it's more emotional than it is factual. I will not consider it. For these reasons, I am discounting it, and therefore I make these findings. Now, that's different from, and mind you, this person has had an opportunity in a forum. And I think what judges often do is they can set time limits. They can cut it off. You don't get to, you know, just spew for as long as you'd like to, and then, you know, slap your hands and say, there, I told them. That's not how you will perform. That goes to that issue of decorum in the courtroom. I think in comparison, when you talk about how do journalists handle a potentially similar situation, I think that there's an obligation to some degree that if there is an extended invitation in a contested situation, that an invitation is extended to both sides in the spirit of fairness and objectivity, even if you know and understand that one side is, yeah, more prone or likely to be more animated, maybe have a very loose relationship with the truth, and is not particularly committed to engaging in good faith. Yes, if you are going to extend any invitation so that you maintain the integrity of your organization and your craft, that you extend one to both and that you manage the response. And that, just like we have to manage individuals in court, I think journalists sometimes have an obligation, especially when they're moderating forums. You got to manage those folks who you've invited, especially when you know that they're vitriolic.
It's interesting how that worked out yesterday, because they started to try to control it, but it quickly, Donald Trump went out of control and commandeered the whole process.
No surprise there.
We should note that both Kamala Harris, as well as former President Trump, were invited to the NABJ. Vice President Harris had another commitment and could not attend. So, but both
in
of
person,
them
and
were,
I know,
were invited.
As I understand it, although she could not attend in person, I believe she did offer to attend virtually.
Right. So the question is, if somebody is rambling in court, let's say we have a defendant who gets up and just spews all kinds of nonsense and crazy talk in court. At the end of whatever he or she is saying, as a judge, I have in the past said, I've heard enough. I'm not even going to hear from the other side. I'm going to rule against you.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's just nonsense. Okay. What you're spewing is just nonsense and does not rise to a defense of anything. So I'm not even going to make the other side speak.
Well, tell me this. Would you ever,
I know you're taken aback by that.
I am. But I also understand it. Would you ever consider, maybe allowing or encouraging that person to self-correct and saying anything to cue them to self-correct and then proceed?
Oh, most of the time you cue somebody as they're going through. You can't say that. You need to be addressing this. That's really not an issue. What we're really talking about is this. You try to do those kinds of cues. But at the end, some people are, no pun intended, just clueless. You know, they won't take anything because they've got an agenda in their head, whatever they want to say, and they're going to get it. They're going to get it out. So do I have to go to the other side? It's like, you know, if somebody is crazy talk, can't you just say it's crazy talk and be done with it?
I think as a judge, I think as a journalist, you could absolutely do that. I think
so why is the difference? What's the difference?
Well, I think part of it is you need to make a record for both sides. I think in the court, you need to at least acknowledge that the individual's been given an opportunity to be heard. But in that environment, both sides deserve an opportunity to be heard. Now, I would allow the other side to waive or give up the right to be heard by saying, you know what, Judge, I think you've heard enough. And it's fine by us if you don't want us to respond. That is perfectly fine by me. I would at least give them the chance to do that, because I think creating and making a record is just that important. But that's my view. And I also can understand just the natural inclination to be frustrated as a human being, notwithstanding being a judge. I can understand the inclination to be frustrated by having somebody there just spewing craziness, because I know for me, I might actually get to a point where I say, okay, I'm going to stop you right there. We're not going down that road. That's enough. Let's stop it. And I remember having, you know, a case or two. I've had a case or two where they've been, you know, they've been just that passionate and just that mean and nasty. And you'll have to just call a timeout and say, hey, listen, you know what? I'm not going to let you do that. The other option, when it's that vitriolic, especially in a courtroom, a judge who's controlling the whole environment can call a timeout for everybody and say, you know, and journalists don't usually do that because they're trying to get the information on the fly. But judges can say, you know what, I'm ordering you to come back in, you know, 10 or 15 minutes or a half hour or after lunch after you've calmed down. And we're going to try this again. And if it's not better after that, then I'm going to shut you down and I'm not going to hear any more from you. I am going to hear from the other side and then I'm going to make a decision. Whether you like that decision or not, it's up to you.
So if we go back to Trump at the NABJ, should the panel of journalists shut it down when he starts questioning the vice president's race, when he starts questioning whether she passed the bar exam, all of these crazy things? Should they just said, we're done. That's it. No more. Cut off the mics. We're finished.
Absolutely. I really do
think. You think they should have?
I think they should have said, hey, listen, you know what? We're going to stop you right there because there are some things that are indisputed. There's no dispute about her race. There's no dispute that she is a member of the bar. There is no dispute about the fact that she's matriculated through her career. These are undisputed facts. And what we won't do is we're not going to provide a forum for you to now create a false narrative about things we already know to be facts. But what we will do is we'll give you an opportunity to respond to the exact questions we've asked. And so that is what I think maybe would have been an appropriate response, but maybe it would have been too generous. Because if you'll recall, the actual question was, given all of this, why should Black voters trust you now? And maybe the actual response that was given was the reason why those voters should not trust the person. So maybe allowing them to spew that was really the answer to the question.
Do you, I want to go to a question that was raised by Joy Reid of MSNBC after the Trump appearance at NABJ. And she said that NABJ got played. And she indicated that NABJ shouldn't have had Trump there because he really satisfied his agenda. One, he wanted to show that he wasn't afraid to debate Black people because he might pull out of the Harris debate. He wanted to show his white supremacist followers that he would take on Black people at their own convention, and he would spew all of these falsehoods and take the focus off Vice President Harris and put it back on himself. That giving him the opportunity to do that, that NABJ got played. So my question is, did NABJ get played in your view? One. And two, do we as judges ever get played for advancing theories or arguments that are ridiculous?
So I'm going to take it in the reverse. Oh, judges get played all the time. There are, I think, both prosecutors, defense attorneys, others who come in with agendas, and that is the specific design of an adversarial process. And sometimes we fall for it as judges, and sometimes we don't. But I think absolutely, you know, our job is to kind of, you know, weed through a lot of this, but do we provide forums, opportunities, platforms for, you know, what sometimes is just, you know, verbal jabberwocky and foolishness? Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we could trade stories about, you know, experiences when we've heard or had this happen. So, and this is all in the name of justice and all in the name of providing opportunities and ensuring that there's access to justice, which again is different for judges because we have a particularized mandate. And our mandate provides a process that says, hey, you've got to give folks that opportunity to be heard. Here's what we know the benefits of doing that is. And, you know, when you follow the process, these are the very, very likely outcomes. Not perfect and not guaranteed, but they're very likely. Now, as it relates to NABJ, as I said before, they don't necessarily, they're aspirational, but they aren't mandated. And they very easily, now here's the thing, they could have done exactly the thing you described. They could have extended an invitation. They could have invited the former president to come and to speak as they did to the vice president. And they could have begun with a question. And at the moment they saw this turning sideways and going down this dark hole that it did, they could have done just what you suggested. They could have cut the mic. They could have said, we are done. They could have said, we will not provide a forum or platform for this. And if you want to go out here and, you know, hold a press conference and tell everybody about how, you know, you had your way with us, then you can do that out there, but you won't do it in here because we won't give you an opportunity to come in here and to further buttress these, you know, statements or false statements that you've made. Now, they could have done that because I think it is just like judges flex and they say, hey, look, you know, you're not going to do that here. journalists can do the same thing. And I don't know, I wonder, in your mind, do you think there was a missed opportunity here? Do you think NABJ missed an opportunity to kind of flex, and instead of being played, they could have controlled the environment and the narrative more?
Yes, I think reporters often get, and this happens in court too with lawyers, they often sort of go down the rabbit hole and try to get the interviewee, in this case Trump, back on target and back on task and back to answering the questions. Obviously, he had no intention of answering any of the questions. All he wanted was the show of being there and the combativeness that he displayed. So you're allowing him to get his message across without doing anything to counteract it. You know, somebody like that in that kind of position is never going to answer your questions. Never going to answer your questions. So if you weren't at a convention in front of hundreds of people, you'd say, okay, we're done. Thank you. And move on. And note in your story that so-and-so did not answer this question.
So how do you believe they should have handled his non-response? Because that's apparently what it was. It was a complete non-response to everything that had been asked.
I think that, and there's some comparisons in court here. There was one comment from somebody on Twitter after the press conference, and it said that Trump came into our home and insulted us to our face. And what's worse, he was invited into our home by NABJ leadership. Mm. Now, that I think is a weighty comment. You invite somebody into your home to answer your questions, and they choose to take it in a totally different direction to meet their, in my view, perverse goals. What do you do about that? Well, I think, as a journalist, you cut them off. And just as I said, you say, we're not doing this. You know, we've given you the opportunity to answer these reasonable questions for an audience that you're trying to court at the ballot box. And we are the journalists, we are the Black journalists who talk to Black audiences across the country. And if you want to get to that audience, you need to answer our questions. If you don't choose to answer our questions, we're not going to give you the forum. We'll withdraw it. Now, you compare that, Judge Gale, to the courtroom. How much latitude do we give people who abuse the court or abuse the judge? How much latitude do we give that person? They're in our house, to use the analogy that the NABJ reporter did. They're in our house and they're insulting us. But not only are they insulting us, they're insulting the court. Not only did he insult the panelist, he insulted all Black journalists. How do you handle that?
I think, again, when it's the court, I think the judge has the duty to acknowledge what's happening. If there is a way for the defendant to self-correct or cure, again, you sometimes have to swallow hard and let him.
How much latitude do you give that person who's just railing against you?
Yeah, I think you probably get like one chance to get it right. And if the next thing out of your mouth is something, you know, disrespectful, untoward, whether it's toward the court or anyone else, then, you know, you're probably facing a contempt warning. You're probably looking at some time out, depending upon how disparaging and how absolutely out of bounds it is. Otherwise, you may be just looking at being completely shut down and saying, that's enough. I've heard enough. Or I'm going to stop you right there. We're not doing this. Now, if you want to try again and actually focus your arguments on what's salient, then I'll let you do that. But otherwise, if this is the path you're taking, you are done. And so that gives a really firm opportunity or a firm warning to the defendant. But I don't know if I would be like you and say, hey, you know what? Thank you for that diatribe. I don't need to hear from the other side. In fact, it's my turn now. And I will be ruling. I don't know that I've
You've gone that far.
I'm trying to think of a time if I've ever gone that far. I'm constantly thinking, and maybe it was just me, but I was frequently thinking about what happens if or when there's an appeal that says, the judge, created an error, or the judge erred in cutting off my argument or not allowing me to put forth evidence or, interrupting, et cetera. And even though I may believe that it is completely lacking in merit, I don't know how an appellate court is going to think or see it. And so I'm looking to protect the record enough to show that I have tried or I've shown patience.
Okay. Let me jump in here and ask you a really, really personal question. Okay.
Okay.
As a Black woman judge, I am sure you had racist people in front of you.
In front of me? How about the whole administration in the city and the city council? But yeah, go with that.
That aside for the moment, let's talk about the four corners of the courtroom.
Indeed. Okay.
How did you handle racist comments, racial slurs, racial innuendos, attacking you in your own house, just like the Trump did with NABJ? So, how did you handle that?
There are times when I think you can turn things back on other people. I remember having an experience where I had a white male appear in my court and say to me, he demanded a white male Christian judge. And I said to him, well, one out of three ain't bad. I'm a Christian, but I'm neither white or a male, and I am the judge, and I'm all you get. So you can try me if you want to, but I suggest you come back here and get this case resolved. And I don't remember if I had to issue a warrant or not, but I remember him having nothing else to say. Now, I also had others who felt emboldened enough to come into my court and to really try to rail against me as a result of nothing short of the racist administration that was in place in the city, having utilized the media, often the local newspaper, to berate me. And so they would then, after reading, print media that was only marginally true or correct, they would come in and they would think that they could say things or comments to me from the bench, and I would absolutely push back. And I would I knew that if I were anyone else, if I were a white male, if I were even a white female, that I likely would never have had the experience of people coming into my court feeling like they were emboldened or empowered to say such rude or disrespectful or nasty things to me. And you're absolutely correct. That, I will say, probably for me came from, a different place emotionally, that said, I have to protect not only my own integrity, that was being degraded by a racist administration, but also protect the integrity of the court. Because as you said, it's not just me, it's now the court that you're demeaning. It doesn't matter who I like to say whose butt is warming the seat. It is the fact that the court itself demands that respect, and you're going to respect it as long as I'm here. And it has to be that, and the court and the judge has to be the one that insists that that happens. So you're absolutely right. As a Black female, it is often difficult, especially being the first Black female. The first minority, anything is hard. It's even more difficult when you have to be a change agent and you have to get people used to seeing something that's different from them. And I suspect that was probably one of the challenges that the former president faced walking into that convention, because I don't know that I've ever seen him in an environment with that many people of color, and particularly Black people. You may see a few people at the rallies. They certainly are not overflowing. They're not overly diverse, is what I'll say. And so, you know, yes, coming into that environment, feeling like he can own it, I think I agree with you. I think there was a lost opportunity for NABJ to step up to the plate and say, you're not going to come here and do this. You're going to be, you know, you're going to abide by the rules or you're going to leave, and we don't care who you are. And
there was a dispute beforehand about fact checking. They wanted to do instant fact checking, and former President Trump's campaign said no, you can't do that. That was part of the hour delay in bringing everybody to the stage.
Well, that's a telltale sign, right? And isn't that the job, I think, of good journalism? Because it happens, you know, at some point inside of the process we've talked about in courts, right? That's the whole point of you know, cross-examination, direct examination. That's a form of fact-checking, is challenging what testimony or information someone's putting out as facts or evidence and challenging the veracity or truthfulness of that. Well, journalists do that all the time, and they should be able to do that instantaneously so you don't lose the thread or the thought or the information. You shouldn't have to go back in your mental annals and be like, okay, when did somebody ask a question about that? Oh, okay, now they're reminding me that maybe that wasn't correct or true.
So a missed opportunity from a journalistic point of view would have been, you don't agree to fact-checking. We're going to go out in front of this audience and say, you don't agree to fact-checking and refuse to participate.
Yes.
That would have been the appropriate, but no, they caved, went out, and let him dominate the 35 minutes. You know, even though he was spewing vitriol and nonsense, he dominated the 35 minutes. The reporters did not.
Exactly. And again, they're reporters. These are professionals. They are seasoned. And here's what I'll also say about, you know, kind of reporting in general. This isn't the first time, and correct me if I'm wrong, this isn't the first time when lack of fact-checking, instant fact-checking, has been an issue that has been impermissible when it comes to the former president, correct? This has been something that's been ongoing, and it begs the question of what is the fear of instant fact-checking?
So we circle back to the, you know, do you allow somebody to have a forum to spew lies? Do you cut that off? And is that the same with the public, with journalism, as it is in the courtroom? Do you cut it off and say, no, we're not going to let you spew those lies? Done. Done. You know, and we do that in the court. You know, I see the total similarity between the two.
I can see it. And I also would be afraid to be a litigant in Judge Tom's courtroom and not have my stuff together. I would be shaking like nobody's business if I did not have all of my stuff together in Judge Tom's courtroom, because you better know my facts better be together better than an Easter speech, because
So we circle back to where we began to wrap this up, and that is, judges come to the bench with biases. You know, we aren't free of biases. We try to control those biases. We try to recognize those biases or prejudices and set them aside. Some judges do it better than others. You know, some magistrates do it better than others. It's just the human experience that you bring to the bench. But part of that also is your, I'm searching for the word and I can't come up with it. Maybe you can help me. You know, you mentioned people being prepared in my court. That's true. That is a bias that I have. I don't want people coming before me who are not prepared. Mm-hmm. They're wasting my time. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to waste. When I was a municipal court judge way back, I had 3 minutes per case. If you took my total caseload and divided it by the number of court hours, I averaged 3 minutes a case. I don't have time for you to be unprepared. Let's move on.
Yes. So it's also about managing expectations inside of those biases.
I don't know whether that's a bias, but it certainly comes out. Mm-hmm. And everybody has their own way of handling those things.
You're absolutely right. And I think judges, to some degree, may be specifically trained to do that a little differently than journalists. And they also, I think, feel a little more empowered because they control the environment. They're expected to control the environment more and to be the temperature gauge, if you will. Journalists, conversely, I think, are in the mode of seeking information that's given to them voluntarily. Judges can compel information. Journalists are seeking voluntary information, and therefore, I don't think always operate with the same level of agency that judges do. And therefore, they tolerate more than judges do when it comes to kind of that information seeking. I think that's perhaps where some of the biggest difference is. And that means they sometimes may even miss opportunities to better control the narrative, as well as the interviewee or the source of the information and being played, if you will.
Well, we'll see where all of this goes. It's been an interesting conversation. I hope our audience enjoyed it as much as I did. You know, looking at this comparison between journalists and judges, and the courtroom and the sort of court of public opinion, there are some similarities and some distinct differences, and I enjoyed the conversation.
This is a wonderful conversation, and I'm like you. I'm going to continue to follow this just to see kind of where it goes and where it lands, but I think that you've provided some exceptional insight, especially having worn both of those hats and bringing to bear your exceptional expertise in these areas. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, and it was fun. So how do people find us? Tell them what to do, please.
Check out Next Witness, Please, anywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including Amazon, Spotify, NPR, and any other platform where you catch your favorite podcast. We are happy to have you listening, and we'll ask that when you do catch us, that you not only listen, but you subscribe, and don't forget to rate us on any of those platforms. Remember, Next Witness, Please.
And if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them to me directly. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N. @ohio.edu. Also, if you have a question about the law or a case we're discussing, you may want to shoot us an email and we'll try to talk about it. Whatever your question is, we'll try to answer it for you in one of our upcoming shows. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back really soon to give you more insights into the law. There's a lot coming up this fall, so stay with us. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.